Great day out there. Holy moly.
Yes, it is. And can I just throw this out? If your wipers are on, your lights must be on.
Yeah, you're always...
That's a state law.
This is maybe a generational thing. It's not a checklist thing for me of do I need to turn my lights on or not, because it's just once it's dark, it turns on. So I am totally guilty of that.
Because this is who I am. I saw a truck this morning, and so I called. I did. And I just said, look, you know, he's not driving recklessly or anything, but I just want you to know, and maybe you should tell all your drivers that it is a state law that if your wipers are on, your lights must be on, because when it's raining, it's hard to see you.
Moving Wisconsin forward, one joke at a time, this is Kristen Bry with As Goes Wisconsin.
Yada, yada, yada.
Hello, Wisconsin!
Hello, Wisconsin. Welcome to the noon hour. Thank you for joining us during your lunch hour. We have lots of good guests for the rest of the show. Going to keep rolling on through. And make sure, if you're driving, that you have your lights on, because it is raining out still, I think, across most of the state. Do you have any, before we get into our first, get to our first guest, do you have any updates on the roads?
Just on the roads. And again, this is from 511wi.gov, really useful website that shows you accidents all around the state. Still around Green Bay, Ashwaubenon, and Appleton for right now. So just be careful. If temps start to slip a little bit, it could get dicey as things get a little icier. So,
all right. Well, up in that neck of the woods is where our next guest lives. John Shelton is a professor at UW Green Bay, a union activist, and an author. And his new book, The Education Myth: How Human Capital Trumped Social Democracy, argues that American politicians have overemphasized education as a magical solution to economic inequality, at the expense of other reforms that maybe would help that a little bit more, like making labor organizing easier, or the right to a job, or universal health care. So welcome back to the show, John Shelton.
Thanks, Kristen. It's great to be here. And I am looking out my window right now, and I can tell you the roads are getting kind of bad. I haven't been outside today, okay, but be careful, especially if you're up here in Northeast Wisconsin.
Okay. Well, thank you for the update from Green Bay. Yeah. Well, I'm super excited about, I haven't gotten a chance to, I've flipped through a little bit of the PDF, but the topic itself seems really interesting. So what was the inspiration to start researching this topic?
Yeah, so there were really two things. I've been a professor at UW Green Bay, of course, and so work with a lot of undergraduate students. And, you know, I was really, to a large degree, inspired by them, because when I was having classes with them, probably 2014, 2015, 2016, a lot of our students, they came to college, you know, kind of thinking this is something that they had to do. Many of them wanted to be there, of course, right? I think, and I like to think the ones in my classes wanted to be there. But their kind of long-term economic outlook was pretty pessimistic, actually. It was, you know, the sort of that, you know, these things they had been promised, you get a college degree and you get a good job and it's going to work out for you. They're pretty iffy about that, even though they kind of knew you, to some extent, do need a college degree. So that was number one. But then number two was when the election of 2016 happened. And, you know, our entire political system was upended by the election of Donald Trump. And so I started looking at some of the data that came out of that. And one of the biggest pieces of data that defined Clinton voters and Trump voters was whether they had college degrees. And that was one of the biggest gaps between those two voters. And so I started thinking about, you know, let's take a deeper look at this. And so the result is, you know, kind of tracing this question of education through American history. What have Americans wanted out of it? What have they hoped to get out of it? And what has it promised them? And you know, as you sort of alluded to in the description of the book, what I found is that in the past 40 or 50 years, too many politicians have basically told people, go out and get the right education and everything else will kind of fall into place, at the same time that they were, you know, sort of either dismantling, systems that had protected working people, or not doing anything to help people as new needs arose. So, you know, one example of that, this is right now, this year is the 30-year anniversary of the inauguration of Bill Clinton. And one of the big chapters in the book looks at the Clinton years and kind of points out that at the same time that Clinton was negotiating NAFTA, actually over the objections, North American Free Trade Agreement, which caused a lot of pain for working people, especially here in Wisconsin, over the objections of Democrats and organized labor, he was also working through his administration to, you know, create new education policies. And the argument was, we have to do this in order to retrain people. I mean, he almost literally says this, to retrain people for the jobs they're going to lose because of NAFTA, right? So, like, don't worry about what's happening to your blue-collar jobs. You're going to get an education and everything's going to be fine. And, you know, that was, you know, really a sort of big moment that, you know, continued a trajectory that was already in place, but pushed the nation even further toward kind of taking for granted the livelihoods of blue-collar people. And I think with some pretty dire results in the years since.
And so when you're talking about education, are you mostly looking at going to college, or is it the whole like K through 12, the whole gamut?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's bigger than just college, right? So there's been some other really good books that have come out recently that just sort of look at, you know, universities, and Will Bunch's book, which just came out, that some people might know, effectively kind of argues that college education has divided people, and that's really sort of where the locus of this, division comes from. But, you know, what I look at in the book is I look at education really from, you know, K-12 all the way through tech college, you know, technical degrees and the university system, and kind of say it's really this overall promise of education, that if we can just bend our schools to the needs of employers, and that's, you know, from the elementary school level all the way through universities, then we can make sure that working people are prosperous. And that's a very recent development in American history, actually. So when you go back to the 19th century, and our country was really the first country in the world to promise sort of universal public education, at least through elementary school. And this was all done on sort of state by state level in the 19th century, but when education reformers were pushing for this, they weren't talking about getting people jobs. They were talking about training people to be responsible citizens in a democracy. All kinds of problematic assumptions about that, right? I mean, African Americans were largely excluded from that promise in many parts of the country. But the promise itself was about sort of education for democracy. And it's really only, again, in the last, 40, 50, 60 years that this whole narrative has been constructed that what the education system is for is to train people for jobs. That's a very new thing. And I think, again, there's some pretty problematic consequences that have come from us as a society kind of accepting that.
Our guest is John Shelton, a professor at UW Green Bay, out with a new book, The Education Myth: How Human Capital Trumped Social Democracy.
And so with that, like for you, when you're arguing or when you're researching this and arguing, is it simply the change that education is now trying to feed workers, or is it also coupled? Like, is that by itself a bad change, or is it because that promise has replaced these other movements? Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's a terrific question, and it's really the latter more than the former, right? Okay. So what I show in the book, right, is, you know, for most of American history, when you have industrialization in the late 19th century, and you've got this significant labor conflict and economic inequality during the Gilded Age, right, child labor, all of these things that people think about when they think about the late 19th century, the primary way that Americans, working people, kind of took aim at that wasn't by saying, hey, we need to get the job skills to succeed in the marketplace. What they were doing was organizing unions and pushing for reforms, Social Security. And much of those things came to fruition in the 1930s and 40s, at least in a sort of partial level. And so the big kind of central premise of American politics from that point in the 30s through the 40s, 50s, into the 60s was around this principle of sort of a broad group of social and economic reforms to make workers' lives better, right? And that's why we have this significant decrease in economic inequality in the 1950s. But this sort of group of economists in the 1950s and 60s coined the term, out of the University of Chicago, coined the term human capital, and that's in the subtitle of the book. And the idea behind human capital and their argument was that what had actually made American workers more prosperous wasn't that they had labor unions or that, you know, tax rates on the wealthy were, you know, super high in the 1950s. They were like 93, top marginal rate was 93% in the 50s. But what had made them prosperous was that they had gotten more education, that they had more skills. Now, that was true, right? More Americans were getting more education. But, you know, what that sort of narrative did is it kind of crept into the you know, public mainstream, the political mainstream, and started to sort of compete with this other narrative that what you needed to do was have these sort of broader reforms. And so in the 1960s, the Johnson administration was sort of this schizophrenic reform effort, right? On the one hand, you know, they pushed for Medicare and Medicaid, right? That's where we get that is in the Johnson years, right? These sort of universal, or at least partially universal programs. And at the same time, though, a lot of those Johnson policies were about helping poor people get skills. That was their argument, is that they weren't ready for the workforce. Well, the reality is most poor people in the 60s were poor because there weren't jobs near them, not because they lacked the skills. And so those two kind of ideas, you know, sort of competed with each other into the 60s and 70s. Reformers, people like Martin Luther King's widow, Coretta Scott King, fought for a jobs guarantee in the 1970s. But politicians really in the 70s and beyond, especially Democrats, because the political landscape of the country was changing, sort of said, you know what, actually, we don't have to have these big ideas anymore, right? We can and just invest in education, and then we don't have to deal with any of these sort of politically contentious ideas like expanding labor rights and other kinds of social guarantees. So that's kind of the long way of answering your question. It's about the fact that politicians pushed education at the expense of all these other things, right? Education in itself, of course, is not bad. And and education does prepare people for jobs, right? I mean, of course it does.
That's so interesting. And so we have to take a break, but when we come back, because I know you said that there's parts in the book, you talk about the Wisconsin idea, you talk about Tommy Thompson, the Walker years, and kind of like, as always, how Wisconsin finds its way in national movements often. And so when we come back, we will still be with John Shelton, who's a professor at UW Green Bay. And we're talking about his new book, The Education Myth, How Human Capital Trumped Social Democracy. Stay tuned. This is As Goes Wisconsin. See what I do. A powder face on a painted fool. Let me slip through. Let me slip through. Why you trying to hold me back? I'm just trying to move.
Styling grace and watch the ankles break.
Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin. I am Kristen Bry. She is Jane Matinere, and we are talking to John Shelton, who is a professor at UW Green Bay. And we're talking about his new book, The Education Myth, How Human Capital Trumped Social Democracy. And before, we were talking about kind of the argument that at the expense of other labor movements and protecting different things that we know work when it comes to mitigating income inequality and wealth disparities, there was this like doubling down on education. That like, as long as you go to school, that will solve it. And we all know with student loans and everything that where we're living today, that is not the case. There's plenty of people who go to very good schools and then still don't feel like the economic promise that they were told is happening. But part of the book, you also said that there's a lot of Wisconsin pieces in there. So what is, like, starting with the Wisconsin idea?
Yeah, so the book, I kind of use Wisconsin as like a ground level. So the book is kind of bird's eye, right? And I use Wisconsin as sort of a ground level example. And of course, as the whole premise of this show indicates, right, like Wisconsin is integral in national politics. Yeah. So I start actually with the Wisconsin idea. And, you know, if there's one thing I could put a moratorium on in our state, it's the abuse of the idea of the Wisconsin idea, right? the abuse of that term. Because what the Wisconsin idea was really about wasn't like partnerships with tech companies, right? What the Wisconsin idea was about using evidence and using scholarship to connect with the public and solve social and economic problems. So when the Wisconsin idea was formed in the late 19th century, early 20th century, read my friend Chad Goldberg's book about this, and he really gets into a lot of this, professor at Madison. It really was about doing something about the economic and social inequality that was really there in the beginning of the Gilded Age, right? And the university folks who, you know, came up with that idea were pretty transparent about that. And they connected with politicians like Robert La Follette and said, let's put some of these ideas into practice. You know, we actually have the Wisconsin idea to thank in part for things like workers' compensation, graduated income tax, Social Security. They all have connections to the state of Wisconsin. And so, you know, that's an idea that goes back into our state's history, but also speaks to how many Americans actually thought about education before this kind of era of the education myth. And what's happened, you know, I kind of already talked about the argument of the book, but there are places where Wisconsin really fits into this. So like in the 1990s, Tommy Thompson came up with this thing called the New Wisconsin Idea, which largely was about meeting the workforce needs of employers, right? It was the sort of the Scott Walker trial balloon thingy, you know, before that actually happened. It convened this whole, you know, commission to study it. And that's sort of what they recommended, was to help overcome poverty by getting people, you know, the right education. That was the whole premise. And so that structured our politics, right? And one of the reasons I argue that we got Walker is because of a lot of the resentment that blue collar working people in this state felt toward that sort of argument about like, hey, if NAFTA is, you know, outsourcing your jobs, sending them to other countries and your factory's closing down, just go get the right education, right? And so Walker really kind of effectively mobilized some of that resentment. It's not the only reason for Walker, but it's something we should pay attention to.
That's so interesting. And so with, like, in all the amount of time we have left, which is about 3 minutes, but like what... Is there a shift, or is there a policy, or is there something that you recommend by the end of the book as far as how to, is it changing our opinion about school? Is it just bolstering these other policies?
Yeah, that's such a good question. So when I wrote this book, I believe in the Wisconsin idea, and the Wisconsin idea is when you're doing this kind of work, connect it in a framework that ordinary people can understand, that they don't have to have a PhD to read this book. So it's really pitched toward everybody. And the idea is, let's have a paradigm shift in terms of how we think about education. Number one, let's stop tailoring it to the workforce needs of employers. Let's start thinking about education as doing something broader and arming our citizens to deal with the misinformation that exists out there, and helping them to be good citizens and training people to run for local office, right? Mm-hmm. So that's number one. Let's do that with our education system. Let's move past these era of bad education policies like No Child Left Behind for good. But more importantly than that, you know, this is something that I want especially people on the left, especially Democrats, to think about. Stop telling people that getting an education is all that they need to get a good life, right? What we actually need is a system that centers the livelihoods of working people in every single argument we make, every single policy that we make. We need a paradigm shift toward that. So let's center the idea that every single person should have a good job, right? Maybe even think about big ideas like a universal jobs guarantee, so everybody knows they're going to have a job. Let's think about things like universal health insurance, and let's think about making it much easier for workers to organize. And by the way, many of those young people, Kristen, that you mentioned who are getting college degrees and not finding the great jobs they thought they were going to get, they're organizing unions at places like Starbucks. Mm. We got to make it easier for them to do that so that they can have, you know, sort of more control, more democracy in their own workplaces. And, you know, I think if we do this, if we center the livelihoods of working class people and the contributions that everybody, whether they work in a Starbucks or work in a, you know, small manufacturing outfit here in Green Bay, feels valued and feels like they have a secure future, that's going to do a lot to heal the political divisions we have in our state and you know, help people deal with this, you know, really contentious level of, you know, just disinformation that we see on social media, and, you know, hopefully reinvigorate our democracy. So I really, really think it's important for people nationally to take this to heart, but especially in our state.
Well, You convinced me. But quickly,
one down.
For people, other people you might have convinced on this segment, where can they get the book?
So you can get the book from Cornell University Press. I promise it's written in a way that anybody can read this. That was very much my intention. You can also get it at the national bookseller online, who should be nationalized, whose name I won't mention, but it is available.
Got it.
There.
Okay. All right. Well, I will link that in today's show notes. John Shelton, thank you so much for joining us. This book sounds fascinating, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks so much, Kristen. Enjoy the rest of the show.
All right. Stick around. This is As Goes Wisconsin.
If you ever find yourself stuck in the middle of the sea, I'll sail the world to find you.
If you ever Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin. I am Kristen Bry. She is Jane Madnair. And this next topic, Jane, you came across this.
We had received an email from someone who was with an organ donation support group and wanted us to run some PSAs about organ donation. And I thought, well, why don't we talk to some of the people who actually do that and find out more specifics about what's involved and what can be used and what you could give now.
And what most of us don't know as far as just being the general public. So we are joined by Colleen McCarthy, who is the VP of Versity Organ and Tissue Donation. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk a little bit about donation.
So I think that it's one of those things where I feel like you hear about it. You hear about kidney transplants and lung transplants and stuff like that. But what is kind of, if you can put it into context of what the need is, either in Wisconsin or even nationally, for wait lists?
Oh, sure. You know, the really interesting thing about organ donation to me is that it is so incredibly rare. It is such a rare opportunity. And so when we look at the national need, there are over 105,000 people on the national waiting list.
Say it again.
105,000 people.
Thousand.
And to take that even a little bit down a level, every 9 minutes another person is added to the waiting list, and every day 17 people die. So over 100,000 people, that list is constantly changing and evolving because people are not getting their transplant in time. And so when we take a look at how many deaths occur in the United States on an annual basis, almost 3 million deaths every year, but only 15,000 organ donors last year. So that need is so incredibly great, and we just do not have enough organs to save those that are on the national waiting list.
So when you say 15,000 donors, that's a combine of people who can donate something that you can donate and still live through. But then also people who've died and were organ donors and saying, if I'm dead, you can take my organ.
Oh, like, good question. Good question.
That's combined?
It's just deceased donors.
Okay.
So 15,000 deceased donors, which really is just a very, very rare opportunity for such an amazing gift.
And is that... That number seems really low to me.
Mm-hmm. It is. And you know, one of the reasons that number is so low is that in order for somebody to be a deceased organ donor, the person has to pass away in a hospital on a ventilator. So that's the first criteria. So on a ventilator in a hospital. And then after that, we also evaluate one of the critical criteria for donation is, did brain death occur? So all cessation of the entire brain due to an injury. So pass away in a hospital on a ventilator and be brain dead. And so that number that really brings down the potential number of organ donors. And then after that, we assess for medical suitability, are organs safe for transplant? And then we talk to the family, and not every family says yes. And that's what we hope to increase awareness of, is for people to understand what an incredible gift it is and the meaning that it can give to donor families through their healing process, knowing their loved one could save a life.
Colleen, I'm baffled as to why the requirement that you be in a hospital on a ventilator in order to be considered a suitable donor?
Oh, good question, Jane. So in order for organs to be functioning and to maintain viability for transplant, a person needs to be on a ventilator. And that ventilator gives oxygen to the body. So even when the person's brain stops working, they're declared brain dead, their body is still maintained in the ICU on a ventilator. So their body's getting oxygen, and that's what keeps their organs functioning until we can find a recipient that's a good match for them.
Wow. And so when, and it goes back to the families. So this was going to be my question, because I feel like the last time, every time I have to update my driver's license, there's that box of like, do you want to be an organ donor? And it's, I feel like it's usually next to like, do you wear eyeglasses? and I check the box. And so like, I think by default, I am an organ donor. I didn't realize all those other conditions had to be like, mm-hmm. if I were to pass, all those other things have to happen too. But like, is that enough?
You know, it's a very, very important first step. To make your wishes known, to designate yourself as an organ donor, and you can do that when you get your driver's license. You can do it online as well to join the Wisconsin Registry. But we always encourage people, don't just stop at that action. Also, talk to your family. You know, when we meet families in the hospital, you can imagine it is the worst day of their life. These families are in crisis and they're grieving, and we are thrown into their lives at a very difficult moment. And so one of the things we talk to families about is what their loved one wanted. And when we can share with them that your loved one made the decision to be an organ donor, they're going to be a hero. That gives them peace. It takes the burden off of them to make another decision at that time. But sometimes when a person is not a registered organ donor, the family has to make that decision. And you can imagine that's not an optimal time to make very important decisions. And so it's not just enough to sign up to be a donor. We encourage people, we want people to do that, but also to share that decision with your family. Let them know what your wishes are.
Our guest is Colleen McCarthy. She's the VP of Versity Organ and Tissue Donation. And we're talking about becoming an organ donor, who can be a donor, any kind of questions. And if you have a question, you can always text us or give us a call at 844-967-2789. Colleen, my father was a mortician, and we used to talk all the time about how important it is, and the best thing that you can do for the people that you're going to leave behind are to set up your arrangements in advance. Mm-hmm. And this is just another piece of that, talking to them that you want to be an organ donor. This is what you want, right? It's just taking that burden off of your remaining family members so that it's been decided. You made your decisions, and here's what they are.
You're right. It's part of healthcare decisions. When we fill out our advanced directives, what we want to happen at end of life, donation is naturally a part of that. And so it's not an easy topic to think about. And I think that's what prevents people from potentially signing up is to think about end of life and make some of those hard decisions. But it's part of your healthcare decision making process. It's a very important aspect to consider.
And so, what else do you feel like the public should know? It feels like you, like I said, you check the box. You can also sign up through Versity, right?
That's right, yes. There is a Wisconsin registry, and you can sign up on donatelifewisconsin.org and also on versity.org as well. There's patient stories on there, donation information, all at your fingertips to help get yourself all informed so you can make a decision that's right for you.
And because there's certainly, you can guess, transplants and organ donations that if you donate it, you no longer can be alive. So like a heart transplant or something like that. But then obviously there's things like kidney transplants. And so, or I assume like bone marrow transplants. And so what are some of the things for people who are alive and also could, whether different tissue or organs that people need, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to be deceased.
Sure. Besides just deceased donation, there's also options for living donors as well. And the biggest need in the United States for a transplant is kidney. So a person who is healthy and has two kidneys can be able to donate one of their kidneys to save a life and get somebody off that dialysis machine and give them a second chance. So living donors are able to donate kidneys. You mentioned bone marrow. That's an opportunity as well. And even in some situations, they can donate a small portion of their liver for another patient too.
Oh, that's so interesting. And so Versity, I knew you guys, I knew less about the organ and tissue donations. Cause as I told you at the break, that's where, you know, my joke about when I was at the blood donation and I won because I'm competitive. That was through Versity too. And so is this, what else do you guys, what is like as Versity as an organization? So there's obviously the donation, for organs and tissue, there's blood donations, Is there anything else you guys do?
Yes, yes. Versity is a big organization, and our footprint is in five states. And so we have a world-renowned blood research institute. We also have a diagnostic lab. Our blood services is our biggest service line, and thank you for donating blood. We appreciate that. And the blood that you donate typically stays here in Wisconsin for patients in need, so important. And then we also have our organ and tissue donation service line as well.
Great. And so I guess with... what do you find that that's through the patient stories is the best awareness to connect with people to understand the importance of what, like, the gift they can give to someone?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think about some of the donor families that we've taken care of over the years, and they are incredible people, just amazing people, so generous, and to know that they thought of others at the, you know, at the worst moment of their life, their generosity, their kind spirit, all of that is just remarkable. It's humbling. And so part of our organization is responsibility is to support our donor families after their donation and after their loss. And so we have an aftercare program where we stay in touch with our donor families. We can facilitate communication between recipients and donor families as well. And even on some rare occasions, we've been able to coordinate meetings between families and recipients. And it is just the most amazing thing to see. And what it reinforces to me how donation helps these people get through their journey of grief. It gives them peace. It gives them comfort years down the road. And I'd want that for all families, to have that extra comfort during some really difficult times and during grief.
And too, as we were saying before, Colleen, I just think if you can talk to your family about it, get it in your will, make sure they understand your wishes, and then explain why you want to do this. Mm-hmm. The whole potential of someone being able to see out through my eyes or just, you know, have a heart or whatever, that makes me happy. Mm-hmm. The potential for that. And I think, as squeamish as this might make people, and I understand why, but you got to look at the bigger picture. You have to look at the bigger result of this gift that you've chosen to give in, and hopefully get your family on board that way too. Because like you said, if it's not in your wishes and it's not in your will, I can understand the pushback by some families, maybe just not understanding the difference that this can make.
Mm-hmm. You're right. Jane, when we talk to families and their loved one did not register, it's very difficult for them. And many times families say no because they just didn't know. They feel like if their loved one wanted to do this, they would have registered, but it's just not necessarily something people think about.
Yeah.
Anything we can do to inspire people to sign up, share more patient stories, donor family stories, that really shows the human side of it, that shows the incredible gift that donation is, and hopefully it encourages people to sign up and give that gift of life.
Are there any donor patient stories that you want to share?
Oh, I do. I have, I think the most amazing story to share, and this happened in 2018, and it was really incredible, and I think it's a highlight of my career here in organ and tissue donation. And it was a story of one of our donors. His name is Dylan, and his mom has shared this story publicly, and his mom's name is Rachel, and Dylan was 24 years old when he died suddenly. And his mom, Rachel, wanted to donate his organs, her son's organs. She felt very strongly that was the right thing to do. And the heart recipient, her name is Nikia. And Nikia had, she was very sick and would likely not have much more time to live without that transplant. And she received Dylan's heart, and she wanted to give a gift to her donor family. And so she got one of those Build-A-Bears, and she took it to her doctor appointment, and she had a recording of Dylan's heart beating inside of her. And she wanted to give this amazing gift to her donor family. And so when we had the opportunity to coordinate that, both families decided that they would meet in person so that Nikia could give that gift to her donor family. And so we were able to coordinate this. And these families, which is, you know, this meeting, you can imagine the emotion behind
it. Oh, my gosh, I'm crying already.
I know. And they opened this up for people to be part of. And this meeting occurred at St. Luke's Advocate Aurora in their healing garden. So this beautiful setting where a lot of families take some time for having peace and comfort. And they coordinated this meeting. And Rachel, who's the donor mom, she wore a black sweatshirt, and it said, stop heroin now. So, you know, you can imagine seeing her son go through addiction, and she, you know, publicly had this saying on, she shared that she said, you know, give your addict's life more worth. And so for her, you know, the ending to her son's story wasn't this tragedy. The ending to Dylan's story was that he was a hero and saved Nakia's life. And so Rachel's listening to her son's heart beat inside Nakia, and she says, oh, it sounds so strong. And to just see what that did for those families. Nakia's parents were there, and Dylan's parents were there, and they were there together because Dylan saved her life, and it was just a beautiful moment.
Oh, what an emotional story. Thank you so much for joining us, Colleen. Colleen McCarthy is the VP of Versity Organ and Tissue Donation. We will link all of the information to our show notes today of how you can become an organ donor. Stay tuned. This is As Goes Wisconsin. Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin. I am Kristen Bry. She is Jane Madnair. Have you recovered?
I was just a mess.
That story. Oh, my.
Yeah, a mess.
It's an incredible story, and I'm sure that's one of many, but 15,000.
Isn't that shocking?
Didn't that shock you?
Yes, it really did. It really did.
And I guess I just, I don't know. I feel like most of us at this point, ask us. I mean, are you signed up to be an organ? Like, as far as
it's on my license, it's in.
Yeah, it's on my license too.
And I know my husband knows.
So now I feel like I got to tell my husband.
Yeah, you should.
And my parents, and be like, This is what I want.
This is what I want.
But also just the additional conditions.
Right. That I did
limit
not know.
The
circumstances
of who finally of the deceased donors. That was so interesting as far as just things that I don't think you ever think about unless you work in the medical industry or you have someone who's on a waiting list.
And don't you think too, unfortunately, I think sometimes as we do in so many things, it's like somebody else is going to do it. Someone else is already a donor. I don't have to worry about it. I don't have to do it. But as Colleen just pointed out, we have over 100,000 people on waiting lists.
Yeah.
And annually, only 15,000 donors. That's not...
That math doesn't math.
No, that's not good math.
And because, I mean, I had always heard that the waiting list for so many of these things is years.
Can be.
And so, but you know, the other person who got a donation through them is Derek Mosley, Judge Derek Mosley. When I was doing my like background to figure out, oh, what do we want to, questions we want to ask, one of their patient stories on their homepage is him and his donor.
No kidding.
Yeah. And so,
what was the donation?
I can't remember off the top of my head. It was, I don't know if it was a kidney, but it was interesting because I remember when we first interviewed him, not the most recent time for Black History Month, but the time in November, he had a very public transplant. This was before I moved to Milwaukee, but then he got COVID. And so like his like public health issues that he's talked about publicly and stuff. But yeah, so he's on the webpage for that. And so certainly check out Versity. We'll link all this stuff today, but on their webpage, you can
sign up right there.
And so if you don't trust the check mark on your license, now don't necessarily trust
mine. Well, I agree with you on that. No, I'm gonna
I know, right?
Sign up twice just to make sure.
Just be doubly sure.
Yeah.
Well, just quickly to end the noon hour, as always, thank you for spending your lunch with us, everyone who did. this just made me giggle. It also makes sense. But, you know, people who work in finance,
mm-hmm.
especially people who are accredited to be able to give financial advice because it is a regulated industry because you're in charge of people's money. Now you can't get around that you can't claim ignorance or claim, well, it was just an emoji when giving financial advice.
There are financial advisors who are using emojis to express their financial advice.
So emojis are investment advice, federal court rules. Some emojis used by Dapper Labs suggested a return on investment. And it was the emojis used. So it was the rocket ship. If you can think of what that looks like.
Okay, I can see that.
Then there's the little chart, like the up and to the right chart emoji.
Oh, so a graph going up.
A graph going up.
Okay.
And then like a little bag of money.
A rocket ship to money.
And so the federal court said that specifically those three count as investment advice. And a New York district court judge wrote in a filing that even when the word profit isn't directly mentioned, the emojis, quote, objectively mean one thing, a financial return on investment. And so he was reading the tweets of a non-fungible token company, so NFT, if we remember those. They're not, I feel like in general, all these buzzwords from 2022 are not as buzzy anymore.
As they were.
But non-fungible token company called Dapper Labs, which is being sued over whether its NBA Top Shot NFTs should be registered as securities. And Dapper's a big mark, and the sales of the tokenized game highlighted clips that exceed $1 billion. I know. This gets into NFTs and like the value, and especially even with some of them losing value, but it's different crypto blockchain world. So the suit claims that the NFTs gained or lost value depending on the success of Dapper's blockchain, making them more akin to securities like stocks and bonds than collectibles like baseball cards and Beanie Babies. And I mean, that kind of gets away from the point of the emojis, but the court hasn't actually ruled on the state of the NFTs yet, but it did refuse to dismiss the case in the ruling that cited the emojis. And so if it ultimately does find that Dapper's NFTs are securities, it could prompt regulators to take a hard look at other NFTs. So like this is a funny story baked inside, I think, a bigger story as far as the continuing of like, what do we do with blockchain technology and right. NFTs and stuff like that. But just the fact like that be like brokers and financial advisors, beware, you're not getting out of your responsibilities. Like, I didn't give that advice if you're like, bye, 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 but only in emoji speak.
Nice try, though. That was a good effort to get around it.
What would be the equivalent for, like, legal advice? What emojis would it be like? The justice. I'm trying to think what even would work as far as I'm not really giving you legal advice if I'm just sending this through emoji, emoji speak. But, yeah, I saw that this morning. I thought it was pretty funny. What's your best emoji? What's your go-to?
Well, and now all I can think of is a rocket ship with a chart going up and an eggplant for whatever reason.
An eggplant. I like how you added an eggplant. Instead of the bag of money, you're like, eggplant.
But that's all.
Seems like a sex act, Jane.
Well, then that's kind of my understanding of what that emoji stands for.
Yeah, that's kind of. I don't know if that was the original intention when it was first created.
Probably
but it
not.
Certainly is now. I'm just going to, if I said legal... There's three different kinds of lawyers that pop up, like a female lawyer, a male lawyer, and a judge. And so
for the legal emojis.
For legal. Let's see, law. Law, police officers pop up. Yeah, there's not as much. It's not as fun as money. Money, money, money.
And I just like non-fungible as a word.
It is a good word.
It's a wonderful, it just has a good mouth feel.
But that is interesting. I should get my brother to come talk to us about that. Because I always thought of an NFT as, you know, an image that can't be replicated and thus its value.
Right.
Because on the internet, things can get, you save as and you constantly can take images and it's really easy. So I would have always thought of it more as like a collectible baseball card versus something that gains and loses value like a stock. But that's not my... area of expertise whatsoever.
You can
so
only be
we'll
good
have
at
to get
so
someone else
things.
To come talk about that. All right. Well, we're going to take a break. When we come back, Tania Fisher's here to talk about Social X MKE's new event, Inspire Her. Stick around. This is Ask Goes Wisconsin.